We will be taking callers for the second half of the Albany Report. If you want to ask a question on the air on today's topic, you can call 518-828-0290 or call in via Skype at WGXC-FM. Good morning and welcome to the Albany Report. I'm your host, former State Senator Cecilia Kacik, and welcome to the Albany Report. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining and we're hoping our regular weekly radio program will help shed some light on what's going on in Albany. We have an exciting show coming up today. I have some wonderful guests joining me here in the studio. We'll be talking about the increased fracking infrastructure that's occurring in New York State and the concerns that this is leading to health impacts on our residents. New York State does not permit high-volume hydraulic fracturing to take place in New York due to health risks, as cited by Health Commissioner Zucker. However, more pipelines carrying natural gas mean more transfer and compressor stations and other infrastructure with cumulative health impacts that are just as concerning. Residents, health experts, and elected officials last week spoke about this issue in Albany and asked the governor, the health department, and DEC to conduct a comprehensive health impact assessment of the growing fracking infrastructure and its impact on New York State's residents. We'll be talking about this later in the show with Robert Need from Center for Sustainable Rural Communities and Susan Van Dolson from Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. They'll be joining us in a few moments to talk about that issue. So if you're interested in sending in a question or calling, write down this number. The number to call in is 518-828-0290 if you have a question on that topic. But before we get to our guests, let's review some things that happened in Albany last week. And we have a number of issues to talk about. The first one I want to mention is pay equity for women. Pay equity has been discussed for years and is finally getting some notice in some very high places. When the National Equal Pay Act was first passed in 1963, women earned about 59 cents to every dollar earned by men for doing the same work. More than 50 years later, the gap has closed slightly. Women in New York today earn 86% of what men earn for doing the same work. The gap for women of color is larger. African-American women make on average an average of only 66 cents for every dollar a man makes, and Latina women just 55 cents for every dollar that their male counterparts earn for doing the same work. Last week, even Pope Francis, in his weekly address, talked about this issue. He said, why is it taking for granted that women should earn less than men? No, they have the same rights. He called this inequality a scandal. It was a call for gender and pay equity heard round the world, and even in the state legislature. Last week, the state assembly voted unanimously on legislation to prevent employers from paying women lower wages simply because of gender. by closing a loophole in the law guaranteeing equal pay for women. The measure had already passed in the state Senate earlier this session and is expected to be signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo. This pay equity bill was originally part of a package that the governor proposed but had stalled amid Republican opposition to a bill that was part of the package that codified abortion rights. The pay equity bill requires that any difference in compensation between a man and a woman be based on a bona fide factor other than sex, including training or experience. The New York State Fair Pay Act specifically prohibits the payment of differential wages between employees on the basis of gender, race, or national origin. The bill would also protect workers against retaliation by employers for sharing information with their colleagues. It was a good week for working women in New York State. But was it a good week for government? Was it a good week to make sure that government is functioning for the people? One of the bills we've been following is the bill that would close the LLC loophole. Senator Daniel Squadron is sponsoring a bill in the Senate that would eliminate a loophole in the campaign finance law that allows wealthy individuals to funnel unlimited amounts of money to the campaign coffers of elected officials and political campaigns. Why is this important? This loophole allows very wealthy individuals to have an undue influence on our political process. Take, for example, Leonard Litwin, a real estate mogul in New York City, spent $5.9 million on political campaigns and candidates in the 2014 elections. The governor has been a huge beneficiary of the LLC loophole. Leonard Litwin was also identified as developer number one in the federal charges against former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver because of the involvement of the LLC loophole. By funneling money through loopholes, these individuals can have much more influence in our political process and what gets done in Albany. Closing the LLC loophole will certainly lessen the ability of very wealthy individuals to have so much say in our political process. On last Monday, the New York State Elections Committee voted to move Senator Squadron's LLC bill, numbered S-60, to the Senate Committee on Corporations instead of moving it to the floor. Senate rules require that the LLC loophole must now be taken up within the next two meetings of the Corporations Committee. It's not clear if this is progress or the bill was just moved to another committee to die. There are two local legislators who sit on the Elections Committee that represent the WGXC listening area. Senator Kathy Marchione represents Columbia County, and Senator George Amador represents Greene County. Senator Marchione voted without rec on the bill, meaning she voted yes, but may vote no if it ever reaches the floor. George Amador did not vote on the bill. Good government groups have been pushing that the legislature address this issue, and even earlier last month, the New York State Board of Elections was asked to take this issue up, but they deadlocked 2-2 and voted along party lines, leaving in place the outdated 1996 advisory opinion that treats limited liability companies like individuals rather than corporations. This is a bipartisan issue. Allowing this loophole to continue leads voters across the political spectrum to believe that the government is up for sale. What we're seeing happening in the Assembly with this bill is that it also moved through the Assembly Election Committee last week and is headed to the floor for a vote. When we see what's happening with our political process and the leaders facing corruption charges and getting arrested, and we're hearing just this morning that the majority leader of the Senate, Dean Skelos, and his son Adam, it was reported by Capitol Tonight that they'll be turning themselves into federal authorities this morning to face federal corruption charges being brought by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. It's not known whether or not he will be stepping down. But clearly, we've got to do something about Albany's pay-to-play culture. Hopefully, the movement of the LLC loophole and closure of it will help us march in the direction of making sure government works for the people instead of the special interests and very wealthy individuals. We're going to be taking a short break, and I have on deck a song that was created by ProPublica, which is a not-for-profit news organization. And they put the history of campaign finance reform to music, and I thought the WGXC listeners would enjoy it. And you'll hear several former presidents and our current presidents speak words in the song. There's also a Supreme Court judge. I hope you can, you'll have fun identifying their voices. Here is Money and Speech, a musical history of campaign finance.
I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited, I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
I don't like all the influence of money in politics.
When people think of Watergate, they think of a break-in, but they don't mention the money that Nixon was taking. From wealthy donors to help him get re-elected, Nixon paid him back in favors just like they expected. To battle corruption, Congress passed a new law, capping contributions to a candidate's hall. The source of the donations had to be disclosed too, and the SBC was formed to enforce the new rules. Some who felt the law went against the Constitution sued, saying limits on money limited free speech too. So the courts kept the cap on how much it can donate, but said spending was unlimited by an outside group that made no more spending limits to promote a cause or to point out a rival campaign's flaws. So while candidates will suck around with brown paper bags, from then on they raise money publicly or left it to pay.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
I don't like all the influence of money in politics.
We should also curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns. And we should also curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns.
Now in the 80s and 90s, there was a new gimmick. Soft money that's disclosed but had no limits. It's supposed to cover each party's expenses, but guys like Clinton used it to help their election chances. There was just one problem. Clinton's party was broke, so he asked for more money every time he spoke. And in return for the $100 million cash in, he let donors use a Lincoln bedroom to crash in. Then the scandal and reform cycle happened again, and legislation was proposed by Fingold and McCain. It capped donations to parties, indexed soft funds, and banned corporate union issue ads right before elections. But with each new reform comes new loopholes. Tax-exempt 527s arose because they weren't explicit about whom they supported. Many still raise money without limits to thwart them.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better. The rules are what they are.
I don't think
by capping the cost of campaigns, and
I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interest.
But the most outside money was yet to be spent. Some argued spending limits broke the First Amendment. Corporations and unions are entitled to free speech. They took it to court. The Supreme Court agreed. Super PACs can raise as much money as they want. They can also use union and corporate funds. The only rule is that they cannot coordinate with a specific party or a specific candidate. But reform opponents were quite done, yet they found new uses for 501c4 nonprofits. Which are a lot like super PACs with more mystery. They haven't had to disclose donors ever in history. Whether Republican or Democrat, you might believe that spending limits jeopardize the freedom of speech. But with each new cycle of deregulation, more money's being injected into our elections.
I don't think
by capping the cost of campaigns.
You're listening to the Albany Report. If you have a question for next week's show or another topic, you can call and leave that question at 518-291-291 WGXC, or send a message on Twitter to at WGXC, or you can search Facebook for The Albany Report, or send an email to thealbanyreport@gmail.com. Welcome back to the Albany Report. And we'll be joined by Susan Van Dolsen. There she is. Susan, can you hear
us? Hi, how are you?
Good. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Cecilia. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Susan, tell us the name of your organization that you're with.
It's called Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion, and we go by SAPE, S-A-P-E, and our website's sape2016.org.
Excellent. Now, joining me in the studio is Bob Need from Center for Sustainable Rural Communities. Did I get that right, Bob?
You did. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Great. I want to thank both of you for joining me. And I know you had a very busy week last week. You were both in Albany. And Susan, I thought we'd start with you. You helped to organize this press conference to bring attention to concerns about what was happening with the infrastructure development around fracking and the health concerns around what's happening in New York State and the cumulative effects of that. So can you tell us a little bit about the press conference and how you all got together to bring that message forward?
Sure. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Susan.
What happened was it started back in about January. I'd been discussing the potential fracking ban, you know, the ban on fracking that had happened December 17th, and health impacts and the recognition that there are serious health effects from exposures to contaminants from shale gas drilling and other infrastructure. And some of the medical people that we had been consulting with in our group about our expansion project here thought, well, you know, let's sit down and we're going to probably be best off to write a letter. So we had we drafted a letter and sent it off to Commissioner Martens of the DEC, Commissioner Zucker of the DOH, and the governor. And our message was basically that we expected some consistent review. If the Dr. Zucker recognized the health impacts from fracking itself, from the high volume drilling, then he should also be looking at the health impacts from the infrastructure, especially because some of the studies that he cited actually included things like compressor stations, which are put along the pipelines every 20 to 50 miles, and they do have serious emissions. So it was about, the letter was really saying, please don't grant the permits for the project that we are talking about, which is the Algonquin Incremental Market project, until a health review is done, the same way that you reviewed the health impacts when you looked at high volume fracking. So that was the beginning. And then we started reaching out to other groups and, you know, thinking about all the different infrastructure projects that are happening statewide, and decided to put together this press conference last Monday and called for a health impact assessment, which is a formal review, and to raise the bar. And New York State has the power, the DEC and DOH and the governor, to do this sort of health review, health impact assessment, and to also evaluate what they're doing statewide with permitting of all these projects.
Hmm. I was very impressed when I watched the video of the press conference to see people from all over the state there calling for the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that was an incredible feat to get so many people talking about the same issue. And they're, you know, from various communities. You're down in Westchester.
Right.
Bob, your group represents what counties?
Schoharie, Otsego, Delaware, Schenectady, Albany, and Montgomery counties.
A lot of very rural areas. And what are you seeing, and what propelled you to come last week to the press conference?
Well, our organization works to support rural communities to make them more vibrant, livable, sustainable, so they have economic development that still maintains the rural character. And like a lot of organizations, we've been in defensive posture for the last several years because of the potential threat of hydraulic fracturing and now this build-out of natural gas infrastructure. We agree that this build-out presents not only environmental issues, but because those environmental issues potentially impact water and air quality, they present health issues as well, which is why we felt it was very important to support this. But even beyond that, our organization tends to look at issues related to rural communities from multiple perspectives, not just environmental and health, but also economic, social, and cultural as well. So we see a third prong to this. The fact that these pipelines are targeting rural communities that, in many cases, have very depressed economies. The residents who are being used as hosts for these pipelines don't have the means, economically or otherwise, to fight for themselves, to protect themselves, their private property, their health, of their safety of their families and themselves. So we see it not only as an environmental issue, not only as a health issue, but also as a social justice issue, because these poor, depressed rural economies and communities are being forced to host this infrastructure build-out. And they're the communities that are going to feel the impacts of this from a health perspective and an economic perspective.
Well, let's talk about the infrastructure and kind of what do we mean by the pipelines and compressor stations. And maybe we can start with you, Susan. You're from a group called the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. So what you've got a pipeline then, and it wants to do what?
Right. So the pipeline that exists now, there are two lines, a 26 and a 30, and they carry gas from Ramapo, New Jersey, all the way up through New England. So Spectra wants to expand their gas delivery. And this goes to really a fundamental issue of need, and that's a whole other story. We could have another segment on that. And this whole desire to move this gas from the Marcellus Shale fracking regions through New York to the coast, where it will eventually be exported, and then just sort of this build-out all throughout our state to transmit, you know, to be a transmission line through rural communities, as Bob pointed out, through our area, which is actually very heavily populated. And the expansion Spectra is looking for actually in some areas will be a 42-inch diameter. And there are a couple new segments. So when you hear the word expansion, the company likes to think of it as like they call an upgrade. That is really a misnomer. There is a whole new segment going through across the Hudson River, and it's landing right next to Indian Point, the nuclear plant. And that's a new 42-inch segment. And we had the town of Cortland hired an expert, pipeline expert named Richard Kuperwitz, to analyze the amount of gas and the quantity going in that new pipe. And he feels this is an overbuild based on what they're doing with the compressor station. So, you know, at the end of the day, what's happening is a tremendous expansion, and it's throughout the state. We have this particular issue here. There are pipelines, metering and regulating stations, which all leak, have fugitive emissions of methane, climate change agent, huge climate change problems, and other contaminants. So rural and more populated suburban areas, there's no part of the state. There was a huge pipeline that went into the West Village. It's by the Whitney Museum. You may have heard about that one, the Spectra pipeline, the other Spectra. This is just a build-out that the industry is employing to transmit their product. I mean, we're the sort of the sacrifice here in New York. We have policies that are looking to do different things, renewable energy, and we're encouraging that. That's part of our mission of all of these groups, is to encourage sustainable practices and not rely on a fossil fuel. So why are we the sacrifice zone of just having an industry take its product from the Marcellus Shale to the coast to overseas?
And Bob, your area is seeing the Constitution pipeline come through, and now there's another pipeline that wants to come through the same area. Could you update us on what's going on with that?
Sure. It's been almost a three-year struggle so far. The Constitution Pipeline was proposed to run 124 miles from the fracking fields of western Pennsylvania to the town of Wright in Schoharie County,
which is near my house, I have to say.
Yes, we know. Another reason for us to fight this pipeline. And it would connect to the compressor station in the town of Wright, which would then intersect with the Iroquois pipeline system. The issue with this pipeline is that it's called a greenfield project, meaning it's running through areas that are relatively pristine from an environmental perspective. So it's going to run through farms and fields and wetlands, and there's going to be 270 water body crossings, for instance. They are going to clear cut 700,000 trees to make the
And it's going through areas that were significantly impacted by the flood from Irene, right? That's
absolutely true. And in fact, our organization this morning issued a press release. We have submitted formal comments to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, pointing out that a federal agency has warned that these natural gas pipelines are very susceptible to flooding. What happens is the floodwaters come through, they scour away soil, they expose the pipeline where it is very vulnerable to collapse or catastrophic failure. So we're urging the DEC to consider this as an issue from a public health and safety perspective as well. But this three-year battle has gone on, and there's been tremendous landowner resistance to this. But the pipeline companies, of course, used the federal courts to exercise eminent domain and have now condemned private property and taken right-of-ways for this pipeline.
And they say, now, you can't use eminent domain unless it's for the public good.
That is how the law reads. But the notion of public good has been expanded over the years. And the Supreme Court actually ruled several years ago that public good can include increased profits for American corporations. And obviously, that's the motivating factor for the corporations building the pipelines is increased profits. But at the expense of these rural communities that we talked about. So in some cases, these same communities are now being faced with a second pipeline. And some of the landowners who have recently had their property condemned are now getting phone calls and knocks on the door by a second pipeline saying, hey, we'd really like to build a pipeline on your property as well. And the landowners know that the process will play itself out in that land will be condemned as well several years from now if the pipeline is approved. So it's a really double punch for these landowners.
And when we do I just want to talk a little bit more about the infrastructure. We're talking about laying more pipes. What's the role of the compressor stations in this? Because I think people don't realize you're not just laying pipes. The gas is under extraordinary pressure. What's the role of the compressor station?
Well, the gas needs to be under extraordinary pressure to propel it through the pipe because it goes a great distance. In the case of Constitution, 124 miles from where it is extracted in Pennsylvania. In the case of the newly proposed Northeast Direct Pipeline, the NED pipeline, it will go 400 miles through New York State into Massachusetts and New Hampshire as well. So the compressor stations are required to push that gas through, essentially. And remember, we're talking about gas that has been extracted through fracking in Pennsylvania, and it carries with it all kinds of issues in terms of contaminations built into the product itself. So that contaminated product is now moving through New York. Even though we have a ban on fracking, we are seeing the impacts of fracking because we are now transporting the fracked gas through the state, again, at the expense of rural communities that host these pipelines, in most cases unwillingly.
May I just interject something right there about that, what he just said? There is a compressor there are several compressor stations along the Millennium Pipeline that currently do exist in New York that were, you know, built relatively recently. One is in Windsor in Broome County, and we had a representative from Broome County there at the press conference. There was somebody from the Hancock compressor station on the same pipeline in Hungry Hill in Delaware County, and then Minisink in Orange County. Now, these are all right now being looked at because of the health by the residents. Residents are reporting health impacts. And it's sort of the burden's been shifted onto these residents to prove what's going on there. And one of the main reasons for the press conference was to give them a chance to explain and the medical professionals to explain what they're experiencing. And they're all in rural areas. And these people are having nosebleeds, respiratory issues, neurological issues, and others, which can be attributed to some of the emissions, such as formaldehyde, benzene. And the problem is with the regulations, they are not necessarily capturing the emissions that are coming off, because the company will self-report once a year, the operator. And DEC will look at that and say, well, they've met the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. But these people are now actually taking it upon themselves to do some monitoring with the help of nonprofits. And they have to raise their own money to do air monitoring and health surveys. So one of the points of the press conference was to say, okay, we're not having fracking, but look at this. We already have people getting sick in our state. And there are already studies showing what compressor stations and other also metering and regulating stations and pigging operations where they clean the pipes can introduce radioactivity and other contaminants. I actually had a conversation after the press conference with DEC, and one of the people in Air Resources said, there are gaps in the regulations. We want to sit down and talk to you. You're right.
Well, one of the people you had at your press conference was Dr. David Carpenter from Concerned Health Professionals, and he said flat out the government is not doing the monitoring that it should be doing. And you're describing residents are taking up that task themselves and saying, we have concerns, we're feeling the impact, and we have concerns about what's coming out, and we're trying to do the monitoring, and clearly the state should be doing this and making sure that the air around these compressor stations stays safe. So you mentioned there's a lack of regulations. So I know that there are maintenance requirements, and there's things like a blowdown when a gas has to be released from the pipeline. Are there any regulations that require the gas companies to alert citizens in the area that they're doing maintenance and that they should maybe stay indoors for a certain period of time, because you don't know how the wind's going to blow, et cetera? Susan?
Yeah, as of now, it varies. According to what happened in Minisink last week, 2 weeks ago, they were told by the company there was going to be a blowdown event on April 15th, but they got the notification on April 20th. So clearly, whatever system is in place is not working properly. And when the people called DEC, they were told, oh, no, it's actually going to be on the 22nd. And one of the residents waited around and tried to with a canister, and they never did the blowdown. So when I spoke with two of the air resources people at DEC, they said that oftentimes they're not even aware. I mean, there's clearly a problem with the notification. They're looking, DEC is looking at this right now, and that's one of the things I hope will come out of this coalition of groups that were together on Monday last week, that we all understand that we need to get something to change at DEC. DEC can do better, and we need to come together and say we want to prevent and stop having people in these areas who are feeling ill. Stop that, find out what's happening, and then we want to make sure that as other permits are being reviewed, like the permits for our project, the AIM project, they should be looking at all of these things and do baseline studies. They should be looking at the spikes in emissions, PM, particulate matter, and formaldehyde that spike in the nighttime, because this is being documented in Pennsylvania already. There have been many studies. It's not as if there were never, haven't been any peer-reviewed studies, because there are peer-reviewed studies, as David Carpenter cited, and also Dr. David Brown, who runs a nonprofit called the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Center down in Washington County, PA. They're doing studies. There was a Harvard study that documented particulate matter had a very bad impact on pregnant women and their unborn children. So these studies are happening. Dr. Zucker could step it up and, work with Joe Martens and the governor and come up with a health impact assessment to address the current problems and the, impending other problems. And that's really our point, is to, get those people together, recognize this, look at the peer-reviewed science, the way they did with hydraulic fracturing, and do some things regulatory-wise and other, ways, and take care of it for the future so that we know what, we're not going to be making people sick wherever there's gas infrastructure.
Susan, And Bob, was there any response from the press conference from the governor's office or the state agencies?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I'd like to reiterate what something Susan is saying. The gap in monitoring and this lack of documented baselines is extremely important here. We're talking about a considerable build-out of infrastructure, yet we're really not prepared as a region to respond to it. And I mentioned before that we view this as a social justice issue as well. Clearly, when private property is being seized, it is a social justice issue when rural residents can't raise the $300 an hour, which is an average, to defend themselves in federal court. When we talk about a lack in monitoring by government agencies and the idea of private people and communities taking on that monitoring, it's extraordinarily expensive to obtain the equipment and conduct that monitoring to be able to identify things like volatile organic compounds and thulene and benzene and methane. So there is a real missing piece here. So if the government is going to encourage this infrastructure build-out, the government agencies must then stand up and say, we're going to monitor, we're going to ensure that the health and safety of the public is considered here and watched on an ongoing basis. And right now that piece is entirely missing. There's a great push to extend the infrastructure, but we're simply not equipped to respond to issues caused by that infrastructure.
And it doesn't sound like the government is responding to calls from the citizens to help.
Well, that's,
it makes
that's,
you wonder who government is working for.
That's absolutely true. But we saw how long it took for the government to respond to the issue of fracking. I'm optimistic that presented with enough persuasive scientific evidence, and there's plenty of it, they will respond. I don't think they'll have much choice but to respond because the issues are truly compelling.
And it was clearly people got involved and stood up and said, we need to take more time to look at this. A lot of activism around hydrofracking occurred. But one of the things that I know people talked about was that the gas industry is exempt from the clean water laws. We really didn't talk a lot about the potential air pollution. So is the gas companies, are they exempted from the clean air laws as well? And is that part of the problem in holding them accountable to appropriate levels of pollution?
Right. From a national perspective, that is part of the problem. They are exempt from many of the environmental laws that other industries are subject to. We're fortunate in the state of New York in that we have a fairly good set of environmental regulations, the State Environmental Quality Review Act, and all of those things can be brought to bear on this industry to apply the kind of scrutiny that's missing at the federal level. So we're encouraging the DEC to do exactly that and Governor Cuomo to encourage the agency to do exactly that.
Susan, if people want to learn more about this movement or this effort or to participate or get involved or to help with monitoring, how do people do that?
Well, as of now, we haven't formed, this coalition hasn't formed its own sort of repository. So I would, for right now, recommend going to our website. And what we'll do is we'll link you to all the other groups that participated and that signed on to our letter that we wrote back in February. So ours is SAPE2016.org. And I'm sure that Bob can share his as well. There's one other thing I did want to quickly throw out there that it's kind of breaking news for everybody. The Medical Society of the State of New York had a vote this weekend, and they actually passed a resolution that they're going to pass on to the American Medical Association. And it is recognizing the potential impact on human health and the environment associated with natural gas infrastructure. And they are urging all levels of government to implement a comprehensive HIA, health impact assessment. So we're extremely optimistic now and grateful because they say that it is their policy to advocate for this with legislative groups. They include natural gas storage, which we haven't mentioned in this call, is very important. There's a gas storage facility proposed next to Seneca Lake, and there's a very active group there. And Dr. Sandra Steingraber is one of the leaders up there opposing this. You may know of this situation from their activism, where many of them have been doing nonviolent direct action for about 6 months, and many were arrested to block construction of this Crestwood Midstream facility.
This so is just to explain what that is. That's to create a liquefied gas storage mm-hmm. facility in the salt caverns near Seneca Lake, and the concern is that will push more inappropriate fluids into the water drinking system.
Exactly. I think it's a CNG. LNG are the export terminals, I believe, and I think this is a CNG, I'm pretty sure. And there's also a methane storage, and it would could very likely contaminate that beautiful lake that provides all this drinking water for the region. So when we talk about infrastructure, we're including quite a lot of facilities here, air and water. New York State does implement the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. The EPA delegates that authority to the states for these kinds of projects. So any when people say, oh, it's a federal project, you know, the state can't get involved and stop it, it's a FERC process. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they're the lead agency. But these permits that have to be issued, air and water permits,
by DEC,
mm-hmm, they are implementing a federal law. So it's at the level of FERC's process. You understand what I mean? People will say, well, the state doesn't have the power because they're below the federal. They're subservient to the federal government. But it's not true in these cases. Our state can do better. As Bob said, we have certain state reviews of environmental issues here in our state, and we may choose to raise the bar, and that's what we're asking. And we're hoping with the Medical Society of the State of New York on board with this sort of effort that's kind of momentum, and we're happy to see that.
Now, will you be posting that letter on your website?
Sure, yes. We're trying to get the official letter. All I have now is one of the delegates sent it to us, a message. So as soon as we have the official letter, it will be up on the website. We also have a Facebook page and Twitter. So we're pretty active on social media as well.
What's the name of your Facebook page?
I think it's just Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. You have to join the group. So we have about 800 members of the group. But many people every day are joining. So I don't know if Bob has one also, or they may have a website too.
Yes, www.ruralcommunities.org. And to Susan's point, there's been an extraordinary amount of collaboration between activist groups. I think everyone realizes that these are universal issues that we're talking about, health impacts of this infrastructure. And organizations from Pennsylvania to Massachusetts and beyond work very closely together, and not just symbolically. I mean, we have conference calls on a regular basis. We confer, we travel, we meet, we talk about strategy. So there's an amazing amount of organization behind this, because everyone realizes that this truly does represent a potential threat for many communities.
And I know municipalities are getting involved. You had several participate in your press conference and pass resolutions. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how different levels of government have gotten involved and participated?
Well, I think because there's been so much grassroots organization around this, local governments especially have been very responsive, because there's this, you know, intimacy in small communities between elected officials and their constituents. So this dialogue is going on, and the elected officials know how strongly people feel. In Schoharie County, which is my home county, there are 16 towns. 13 of those towns have passed bans or moratoria on fracking. The county's passed a resolution opposing the pipeline. The county has passed a resolution opposing the importation of fracking waste. They've been very progressive and have really responded to the concerns of the individuals. Now, of course, they're frustrated to some degree because there is a federal component here. And just like the individual landowners, they feel steamrolled to some degree by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which seems to have a tendency to rubber stamp these projects.
Susan, what can state legislators do to help support your effort at getting information, getting the state agencies to be more proactive?
It's a great question. A few of them showed up at the press conference to support what we were doing. As Bob mentioned, the counties our counties, the three counties in our area, all passed resolutions. And our state legislators, one of them in particular, has been extremely involved with many issues, health and safety, a lot having to do with the nuclear plant. So they've been writing letters.
Who is that?
Her name is Assemblywoman Sandy Galiff.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have Senator George Latimer has been involved, and Assemblyman David Buchwald, and other local, other state-level legislators have attended press conferences. We also sent a letter to DEC, and the elected officials, many of them signed the letter, which is on our website, too, at the comment time for the air and water permits. And they said the entire region has passed resolutions and been calling for health and safety requirements, and analysis to be done. And they support that. And they asked for the DEC to withhold the permits until a health impact assessment was completed. So as Bob is saying, it's interesting that as the local county and state officials are more educated about what all the impacts are, they are actually trying to use their voices through resolutions and letters, and can and should continue. The one other idea that we had come up with at one point was perhaps to have hearings held in the state legislature about the state implementation plan for the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. So that is another possible way that they could become involved. And then they also, what we say is, please, everything that you put on the record, make sure you copy the FERC docket, which is where the repository of all of our, correspondence, back and forth, comments, because FERC needs to see what's going on in New York. Mm-hmm. FERC needs to understand that the industry has a lot of power, but there are a lot of people with power. We have a lot of people, and our elected officials are learning and are interested in making sure that they uphold their most important responsibility, which is to protect the health and safety of the people of their state. So they've been pretty good. I don't know every single legislator in the state, and I'm sure we've got a combination of good and bad in terms of being aware or proactive. But as we work more closely with them, more and more of them are aware.
Well, public hearings is one of those vehicles where you can provide information to the public. You can gather testimony, and people have to be truthful and honest in their presentation of their testimony. So it's a really good way to discuss issues like this and to understand and maybe get some information going to the state agencies to help them, mm-hmm. make a informed decision and maybe step it up if they need to. In the Senate, you're only able to do public hearings if you're in the majority. So the Republicans in the Senate would certainly be able to do that. The Democrats in the Assembly would be in the position to hold public hearings. But even if you're in the minority, you can have a public forum. So there's definitely ways for state legislators to help get the information out and get the issue discussed and press the state agencies. When the state, I have a question for Bob or Susan. When the state DEC looks at granting the permit, do they look at each pipeline or each application on its own merits, or do they really look, like you have two pipelines now coming through your area, do they look at both the cumulative impact of that, or are they just going to do the Constitution pipeline review and then we'll review the NEP pipeline?
The NED, yes.
NED, sorry.
Well, that's the challenge for us, is to try to get the perspective shifted, because the industry wants them to look as narrowly as possible at one single project. We want them to look as holistically as possible at the cumulative impacts. Clearly, if you're proposing two pipelines to run through essentially the same communities 200 feet from each other, they should be considered as one potential impact, both from an environmental and economic perspective. But that's sometimes a struggle for us, because they like to try to narrow this down. It's much easier to evaluate it on an individual basis. And there's also a challenge with even the individual pipelines tending to try to segment their project and say, well, this piece isn't really part of the project, so you don't need to consider that. And the Constitution's a perfect example. There is a compressor station in Pennsylvania that's at the very beginning of this pipeline, but it wasn't even considered by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission because the pipeline company claimed it was not part of the project when everyone knows it is. So you have to really keep a close eye on these projects and encourage the whole project to be looked at.
And
statewide too, Cecilia, one of the reasons that the press conference was powerful was we had about 10 different people representing 10 different parts of the state. Right. So if you look at, and we had a big map, which you may have seen on the Facebook pictures, showing all the projects. And you say, you're looking at all of this and you're saying, okay, is DEC looking at, you know, this many different facilities and pipelines? No. As they evaluate a permit, they evaluate that application. They're not tying that into the overall holistic view of our state being, you know, inundated. As Bob said earlier, it happened so quickly. When the drilling first started, people didn't realize that the next thing was going to be getting that gas to market. So what happened? All of these things started to expand before and the regulations caught up. That's actually, believe it or not, what the guy at DEC said to me last week on the telephone. He even said that. This happened so quickly. We aren't looking necessarily at the cumulative impacts statewide. Plus, you know, the burden of certain areas that already have a high air pollution content. Our area has an F from the American Lung Association.
Hmm.
For air quality already, and I think 75% of the residents of this region are compromised. Either they're young children, they have respiratory issues already, or other illnesses. So the state really has to take that holistic view, not only of the projects themselves, cumulatively, but the whole build out
of what, and also, as you said, just what's going on now. There may be compromises in the air now, so you've
right.
got to deal with that, and you're adding, you know, potential further pollution from the pipeline construction.
Right. I don't think a lot of people are as aware. It's a more challenging fight in a way, or education process, I guess, because people were able to visualize the fracking process, you know, from movies and social media. This is harder in a way to really have people learn and understand. They need to talk to people who live in these communities. That's why it's very powerful to go on some of these websites and look at the videos or the interviews with the impacted residents in other places. It doesn't have to be New York, because we're just starting this, you know, with this kind of huge build out. But
I have a question, Susan, about the application process here in New York. When the Constitution Pipeline is before the DEC and is waiting for its permit, correct, Bob?
Yes, they've actually got a tentative permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and now are waiting on DEC and Army Corps permits.
When DEC reviews their application, does the company have to explain their future plans?
No.
Are we seeing a very minimal description of what's occurring, and I think people are like, oh, it's just this and that's it.
Yes, that's exactly how they want to present it. And again, I mentioned before that we're very fortunate in New York that we have the State Environmental Quality Review Act and other regulations that, unlike the federal regulations, require that you look at the entire project from this holistic perspective. So I think it's important that we emphasize that. And if I may, just illustrate how absurd this can get by segmenting these proposals. The Constitution Pipeline has already stated that up to one-third of the route will require blasting in order to put the pipe in the ground because of shallow bedrock. So if the Constitution is approved and it's blasted and dug and the pipeline is put in the ground, and then the NED pipeline, which is following behind it, comes 2 years later, which is kind of an average, they are going to have to go through the same geological formations, which will require them to blast. Except in this case, they'll be blasting within 50 or 100 feet of a working high-pressure natural gas pipeline.
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
No, it's not a good idea. And it's ridiculous to assume they are two separate and distinct projects, when in fact they will impact the same landowners, impact the same communities, impact the same regions, But the potential safety and health risk will be exacerbated by the fact that there's now two of them.
Wow.
Yeah, the same thing is happening in Algonquin with Spectra. They have segmented the projects as well. They claim they're separate. There's the AIM project, and then Atlantic Bridge is the other one, the next one, and there's a third one. This is the way the companies try to avoid the full environmental review. They will segment the project. Now, DEC did tell us that one of the compressor station expansions that was proposed for the second project, the Atlantic Bridge, they told Spectra that they could not expand Southeast again a second time because the DEC said it was segmentation. So I thought that was very interesting that New York State, you know, again, here we go with, well, it's a federal project. Does the state have the power? And in some ways, yeah, they do. Now, as far as CEQA, I just want to ask Bob this. I was under the impression from lawyers that we've worked with that CEQA does not apply to FERC projects. So you keep referring to CEQA, but maybe I'm not sure. We actually put in our resolutions that they use CEQA because it is a higher level than NEPA. But they're under the NEPA law, as far as I know.
They are. But what we try to do is encourage state agencies to consider CEQA their inspiration and guidance, if you will. We've established this standard in New York State that we look very comprehensively at projects and proposals from their environmental impact perspective. CEQA is very comprehensive. It provides the kind of guidance we hope that the DEC will follow, regardless of what the federal requirements are.
Right. So it's an aspirational thing, but it's the right type of method that they should be using. Correct.
I just want to make a point that, you know, people think that because we're not allowing hydraulic fracturing to take place in New York, they think that we don't have to worry. We've slain that dragon. But clearly this conversation and your press conference last week really brought out that there's a lot still going on related to hydrofracking infrastructure that we need to be concerned about. And there's nothing stopping state legislators from putting in legislation to help inform the public of what's occurring and make sure that DEC has the regulations in place to better monitor this build out and make sure that regulations are in place to protect the residents.
That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to understand that it's a very little comfort to a landowner who has a high-pressure natural gas pipeline carrying frack gas 50 feet from their house that we don't have fracking in New York, because essentially, as far as they're concerned, they're being fracked the same as people in Pennsylvania are being fracked.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on the show. This was very informative. And Bob and Susan, if you could give us one more time your contact information or Facebook page that people can follow up with your organization if they want to get more involved or get access to documents that you've put out or hear about the press conference. Who do they contact, Bob?
Sure. We're the Center for Sustainable Rural Communities. Our website is www.ruralcommunities.org.
And Susan?
We're Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion, and it's SAPE2016.org. And we're on Facebook at Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion as well.
Susan and Bob, thank you so much for coming in, for doing all the work that you're doing. I'm sure it's well appreciated by so many.
And thank you for having us on and highlighting this issue. It's very important, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. Coming up next week on the Albany Report, we'll be talking about public education with Dr. Kate Farrell, superintendent of Catskill School Districts. School budgets are coming up for a vote, and there's a lot going on with budgeting and policies, and we'll be hearing directly from a local school superintendent about how that's impacting her school and our kids. So until then, please enjoy the sunshine and get out and enjoy this wonderful weather. Until next week, I'm signing off.